Secondly, the days of Amos. And thirdly, the message of Amos. The callings of Amos, the days of Amos, and the message of Amos. We begin with the callings of Amos and verse 1. The words of Amos, who was among the sheep breeders of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. Well, here we're introduced to Amos. We're told several things about him. We're told that he is among the sheep breeders of Tekoa. Now, this tells us something about where he was from and what he did. Tekoa, if you'll look on the back of your bulletin, you'll see a map there. And you'll see an arrow that shows you from Tekoa to Samaria. Tekoa is in the southern kingdom of Judah. It's about 12 miles south of Jerusalem. It's about 6 miles south of Bethlehem. It is one of the cities that was built for the defense of Judah by Rehoboam following the division of the kingdom in 931 BC. This is Amos's hometown. Now, we're told that he was among the sheep breeders of Tekoa, and this Hebrew word that is translated sheep breeder does not mean a simple shepherd. It's more of a manager of the sheep. The only other place where this term is used in the Old Testament is of King Mesha of Moab, who regularly supplied lambs and wool to the king of Israel. You read that use in 2 Kings 3, verse 4. It may be that like King Mesha, Amos was a supplier to royalty. Or scholars also look at this root in the various languages of the ancient Near East, and in the Arabic, it has the connotation of a supplier of a particularly fine kind of wool. In other words, Amos may have bred a very certain sheep, special sheep, known for their fine wool, and that might have been the wool that he provided. In either case, we need to avoid thinking of Amos as some kind of uneducated peasant. Someone would think, well, Amos, he was a shepherd. He was just an uneducated peasant. No, he was more than that. In fact, if we glance ahead in the book, we read in Amos 7:14, Amos says, "I was a sheep breeder and a tender of sycamore fruit." So we already know he's a sheep breeder, and then we find out that he deals in sycamore fruit, which may be confusing because when we think of sycamore trees, we don't think of fruit-bearing trees. But the sycamore in the ancient Near East was not the sycamore that we know in North America today. It was closer to the fig, and it bore fruit that could be harvested and sold for profit. So as a sheep breeder and a tender of sycamore fruit, Amos's first calling was what we might call an agricultural businessman. He was an agricultural businessman, both with the flocks and with the fruit. And yet, that is not the primary thing for which he is known, is it? Amos came to have a second calling, and that was the calling of a prophet. We're sort of moved in that direction, even by the very opening words. We read the words of Amos. And that phrase has prophetic and covenantal connotations. For instance, in the prophecy of Jeremiah, the very first words in that book are the words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah. That introduces a prophetic book. Deuteronomy 1 begins, "These are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel." Deuteronomy is sort of the ultimate covenantal book. It is even structured according to the pattern of ancient Near Eastern covenants. And when we link this idea of prophet and covenant together, we get a sense of what a prophet was. A prophet for Israel was a covenant messenger, a messenger from the covenant Lord Yahweh, and he often came bringing a covenant lawsuit against God's people. He was something of a covenant lawyer. When God made his covenant people, he made promises, but they also had responsibilities. And when they failed in those responsibilities, sometimes God would send a prophet to bring something like a covenant lawsuit against them to convict them of their sin. So from his calling as a shepherd, sheep herder and fruit tender, Amos was called to be a prophet. And specifically, he was called to be a prophet to the northern kingdom of Israel. Again, look at your map on the back, and you'll see on the left-hand lower quadrant the nation of Judah. And then right in the middle of that arrow, you'll see a boundary. That boundary divides the southern kingdom of Judah from the northern kingdom of Israel. And then you'll see other nations about. We'll get to some of these later in the chapter. Phoenicia, Syria, Ammon, Moab, and Teman. So Amos was from the southern kingdom of Judah, but he was sent to be a prophet to the northern kingdom of Israel. This meant he came as something of a foreigner from a rival kingdom, a status which was not likely to receive a warm welcome. Well, that brings us to our second point, the days of Ammon, the historical time in which Amos. Ammon is on this paper. But the prophet's name was Amos. And verse 1 also gives us specific details about his historical setting. We're told in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. We ought to have a brief history lesson here. The history of Israel can be divided between the time of the united monarchy and the divided kingdom. See if I can do better with one of these other markers. The united monarchy began with Saul. It was really completely brought together under David and continued under Solomon. And then the kingdom was divided in 931 BC. The kingdom was divided into two nations, Israel in the north, and Judah in the south. And the first king of Israel in the north was Jeroboam the first. The first king of Judah was Rehoboam. And then there's a number of kings that follow in each of those lines. But this was a tragic situation where the kingdom was divided, 2 tribes in the south, 10 tribes in the north. So Amos lived in the southern kingdom of Judah, and he was during the reign of Uzziah, which went from 792 to 740. Of course, these are all B.C. And also during the reign of Uzziah in the south and the reign of Jeroboam the second in the north. And Jeroboam the second reigned from 793 to 753. So this gives us a general time frame for Amos's ministry. Now verse 1 also refers to 2 years before the earthquake. And this is likely the same earthquake referred to in Zechariah 14:5, which says, "Yes, you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah." So when we take the historical situation of the kings, what we know of the earthquake, and archaeological findings related to these, we get an approximate time of 760 B.C. for Amos's prophetic ministry, you know, give or take 5 years or something there, probably around 750 B.C. That not only gives us a time frame, but we also know something about the situation in Israel during that time frame, during the reign of Jeroboam the second. Turn with me to 2 Kings chapter 14. 2 Kings chapter 14 provides a summary of the reign of Jeroboam the second in the northern kingdom of Israel. I'm going to start reading 2 Kings 14 at verse 23. In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria and reigned 41 years. And he did evil in the sight of Yahweh. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. He restored the territory of Israel from the entrance of Hamath to the sea of Arabah, according to the word of Yahweh, God of Israel, which he had spoken through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. For Yahweh saw that the affliction of Israel was very bitter, and whether bond or free, there was no helper for Israel. And Yahweh did not say that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did, his might, how he made war, and how he recaptured for Israel from Damascus and Hamath what had belonged to Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Jeroboam rested with his fathers, the kings of Israel. Then Zechariah, his son, reigned in his place. This is very interesting because we see a bit of a contrast here in the description of Jeroboam and his reign. We read in verse 24, and he did evil in the sight of Yahweh. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin. Now, if you've ever done one of those read through the Bible in a year programs, or if you've just read through the book of Kings, you know that this is a formula that's used often of the kings in the north, in Israel, that they did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. It becomes just a negative thing because he was the very first king in the northern kingdom, and he set a trajectory away from the will of the Lord. And so anytime a king is a wicked king in the north, he's likened to Jeroboam the first, Jeroboam the son of Nebat. And so on the one hand, Jeroboam the second, one of his later descendants, not his son, but one of his later descendants who shared his name, is utterly wicked. But then we read in verse 25, he restored the territory of Israel from the entrance of Hamath to the sea of the Arabah, according to the word of Yahweh, God of Israel, which he had spoken through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was from Gath-Hepher. So there's a sort of a sense of irony here. The reign of this wicked king in Israel was a time of national expansion and prosperity. So how could this be? Well, verse 25 tells us that it was in fulfillment of prior prophecy of Jonah, that through Jonah, Yahweh had prophesied this expansion. And then verses 26 through 27 tell us that it's due to the compassion of Yahweh, compassion he has even on his erring children, which is certainly something we need to be grateful for. That even though Israel, the nation of Israel at this time, was wandering far from the ways of the Lord, following in the footsteps of their first king under their current king, yet the language here is very similar to the language we get at the beginning of Exodus when God hears his people in Egypt. Verse 26, for Yahweh saw that the affliction of Israel was very bitter, and whether bond or free, there was no helper for Israel. And he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Commentator Ralph Davis has a few comments about this situation, this sort of irony between the wickedness of the king and yet the prosperity of the nation. He reminds us prosperity may be a sign of Yahweh's compassions, but not of his commendation. Get that? Prosperity may be a sign of Yahweh's compassions, but not of his commendation. He may allow Israel to thrive, the northern kingdom to thrive, not because of their goodness, but in spite of it. And he's not necessarily commending all that they are doing because he grants them prosperity. And then Dr. Davis tells us whether nations or individuals, do not mistake Yahweh's patience for his pleasure. Do not mistake Yahweh's patience for his pleasure. Yes, Yahweh was patient with the northern northern kingdom of Israel in their sin. That doesn't mean that he took pleasure in their sin. Amos was a foreigner prophesying in Israel during a time of material prosperity. Now, people are sometimes ready to hear the warnings of a prophet when things are going bad, right? Things are going bad, they're ready, well, somebody give us an explanation. And they'd be ready to hear a prophet. They're not so likely to do so when things seem to be going well. And that was the case in the northern kingdom at that time. They may well share in modern America's priorities, as summarized in one of Bill Clinton's slogans during his first presidential campaign, "It's the economy, stupid." We heard that over and over. And the point was, really, the only thing that matters, the only thing the electorate cares about, is the economy. If we're thriving economically, then we're doing okay. And I don't say that simply to disparage Bill Clinton, because that's the kind of philosophy that informs every place on the political spectrum today. Material success is often seen as the ultimate gauge of the goodness of a nation. Well, Amos will repeatedly warn us not to mistake economic success with spiritual blessing. And that brings us to the message of Amos. We've already hinted at some of his prophetic message, which is going to occupy the remainder of the book. But we get a preview of it in his words in verse 2. Yahweh roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. The pastures of the shepherds mourn, and the top of Carmel withers. Now, this is the first prophetic statement of the book, the first words of Amos that we heard of in verse 1. And it presages all that is to come. First of all, we have the Lord prominently there, the very first thing in the sentence. This, you see it in all capital letters, it's Yahweh. It's the covenantal name for God. And of course, most appropriate for what is Amos. He is a prophet. He is a covenant messenger. He is bringing the covenant word from the covenant God, indeed a covenant lawsuit against Israel. And what does Yahweh do? He roars. Now, Yahweh roaring sometimes precedes a statement of judgment. We have an example of this in Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 30 and 31. We read in that prophet, "Therefore prophesy against them all these words and say to them, Yahweh will roar from on high and utter his voice from his holy habitation. He will roar mightily against his fold. He will give a shout as those who tread the grapes against all the inhabitants of the earth. A noise will come to the ends of the earth, for Yahweh has a controversy with the nations. He will plead his case with all flesh. He will give those who are wicked to the sword, says Yahweh." So clearly there, Yahweh roaring is announcing judgment to come. But it is also the case that sometimes Yahweh roaring precedes blessing. We see this in the prophet Hosea, Hosea chapter 11, verses 10 and 11. "They shall walk after Yahweh. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, then his sons shall come trembling from the west. They shall come trembling like a bird from Egypt, like a dove from the land of Assyria. And I will let them dwell in their houses, says Yahweh." This is a picture of blessing, a picture of restoration to the land. Well, in this passage, does the Lord roaring precede judgment, or does it precede blessing? Well, as we'll find out, it precedes judgment. Jeffrey Niehaus, another commentator, says, "In this passage, the verb warns of imminent danger. It signifies the kind of roaring that a lion does when it is about to attack." And as someone who attended to sheep, this was something that Amos probably knew firsthand. He had probably dealt with a roaring lion threatening his sheep. And already we anticipate that this is to be a prophecy of impending judgment. From whence does this warning come? Well, we're told that. Yahweh roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. Now, Mount Zion, located in Jerusalem, was the location of the temple. It was God's special place of residence among his people. Now, the northern kingdom of Israel had rejected Jerusalem as the center of worship. The kings in the north did not want their people beholden to the southern kingdom for their spiritual life. They didn't want them making those annual pilgrimages out of Israel into Judah in order to worship Yahweh. So they had created alternative centers of worship in places like their own capital, Samaria, and cities like Bethel, which included just both completely pagan worship. Baal worship was set up in some of those places, as well as false worship of the true God, the kind of thing we were warned against in our children's catechism lesson this morning. Now, as we will see as the book progresses, the fact that this message, this prophecy of warning judgment, comes from the southern kingdom does not mean that all is well in the southern kingdom of Judah. As Jesus would say much later to a woman in Samaria, "You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We Jews know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews." Yes, the southern kingdom had the true worship that had been prescribed by the Lord. The Samaritans, now that's talking really later on in the history, after there's a confluence of peoples there in that northern kingdom. But they do not know what they worship, because long ago, during this time of the divided kingdom, they had separated themselves from true worship in Israel. Well, what will be the result of Yahweh's roar from Zion? "The pastures of the shepherds mourn, and the top of Carmel withers." Carmel is the northern mountain range in the northern kingdom of Israel. Its name in Hebrew is a contraction meaning Garden of God. And it had that name because it was just lush and filled with vegetation. We read of it in Isaiah 35, 1 through 2. "The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the excellence of Carmel and Sharon." So when the prophet wants to give a picture of the change in a desert from a dry place devoid of virtually all vegetation to a place of lush growth, he compares it to Carmel. That wilderness will become like Carmel. Now, Isaiah presents a prophecy of spiritual renewal akin to the wilderness and desert becoming like Carmel. So when Amos prophetically declares the top of Carmel withers, he is predicting devastating judgment upon the most fruitful region in Israel. That most fruitful place is going to wither, just like in the wilderness. And if Carmel bespeaks vegetative fruitfulness, the pastures of the shepherds speak of places identified with a bounty of flocks, the kind of places with which Amos himself would have been familiar in his own country. And he seems to be employing here a literary device that is known as a merism. We find this often, particularly in the Psalms, a merism. A merism is a figure of speech that uses two opposites to indicate totality. And so we might say day and night. And by saying day and night, we mean all hours of the day. We might say from the rising of the sun to the setting of the sun, and we mean all that geography that's embraced. And here, he speaks of the pastures mourning and of the top of Carmel withering. What he's saying is that the judgment that is coming to Israel is going to involve total devastation. Whether you think of it as from the heights of the mountains to the plains, whether from the north of Carmel to the south, or whether you just think of the difference between this vegetation and the flocks, it's going to be this all-embracing devastation. We see then that the brief statement in this verse sets the tone of the prophecy to come, one of warning of great judgment. While focused on the northern kingdom of Israel, we will see beginning next time that the judgment will not be limited to Israel. Yahweh is God over all nations, and his prophet will speak to all nations, even to his own homeland. But the role of a covenant lawsuit is not merely to proclaim judgment against those who have broken the covenant. It is also a call to repentance and covenant renewal, and we will see glimmers of grace in this prophecy as well, particularly in its conclusion. So as we enter this study of Amos, we will want to be prepared to be convicted of our own covenant unfaithfulness. This situation in Israel during the reign of Jeroboam II is very similar to the situation in our own nation today. Their temptations are very much our temptations. Like them, we have much material prosperity. And in our particular congregation, we've all experienced many material blessings. But let us remember the warnings that Davis gave to us. Prosperity may be a sign of Yahweh's compassion, but not of his commendation. We need to consider that. And do not mistake Yahweh's patience for his pleasure. We may, as the church, face judgment in history. We will certainly face judgment at the end of history. This prophecy from Israel in the 8th century BC has much to teach the American church in the 21st century AD. May we have ears to hear and hearts to believe and obey.